Welcome back to Failover Clustering in Windows Server 2012 R2. In Module 4, we're going to be taking a look at the storage considerations associated with failover clustering. We're really going to kind of break this down into three specific sections here. First, we're going to look at kind of general storage considerations. Next, we're going to go and take a look at software-defined storage. And third, we're going to be taking a look at our SMB storage and how that gets used with the new concept of what we call a scale-out file server, and see how we're really trying to converge these different solutions and take advantage of the new enhancements around software-defined storage. With that, I'm going to turn it over and let's go through our quick introduction to cluster storage.
All right. Thank you, Simon. So we're going to start out in this section. We're going to talk about some of the different considerations when for storage for a cluster. So the first point I want to just, as you look at the slide, there are many different choices, and there's many different flexible choices. So historically and kind of traditionally, when people think about storage for a cluster, they kind of get all focused in on that far left quadrant on fiber channel, and they think that clusters are expensive and they have to use really high-end, expensive fiber channel storage arrays. And the answer is there are many different choices. So if you look, if I just kind of work my way through and talk about these different options that you have in creating clusters, you can use fiber channel with traditional fiber channel external storage arrays. You can use iSCSI based and do over Ethernet. You can do fiber channel over Ethernet, FCOE. And then there's what I call a SAS RBOD, which is kind of your external SAS array, which has a controller in it. That's what I refer to as a SAS RBOD, is this external storage array with a controller in it that does a SAS connectivity. Now, those are intelligent external SAS arrays, but you can also do simple SAS RBODs, which are SAS external closures connected via SAS to two servers, and then you have some disks inside of them, and you use spaces as a mechanism to create for software to create high availability.
Now we do have two acronyms here. You did do RBOD, which is a redundant bunch of disks, right?
Yes.
And then I just want to make sure we're clarifying these acronyms here. And then JBOD is
Just a bunch of disks.
Okay.
And that's kind of the controller differentiation of being the RBOD is that it's an RAID in a controller in the storage array, where JBOD is just simple disks attached, no controller, no nothing, just pass through. You can also do RAID HBA, so you can have an HBA where the RAID lives in the controller, the HBA inside the server. So you can have, so just kind of the differences there is that one has RAID in the storage array. Then you have RAID in the controller, in the HBA, and then RAID in software with like spaces at the higher level. You can also do SMB-based storage. So if you like NAS and network-attached storage, you can absolutely embrace that with Hyper-V. And then on the replication side, there are many replication solutions to integrate with clustering, whether that be hardware-based replication. You want to do EMC, SRDF, CE to do a multi-site cluster, or HP CLX, or... And then the software side, there's third-party replication, such as DoubleTake or Semantic Storage Foundation for Windows, which can enable creating clusters with replicated disks beneath them. And there's application-level high replication, whether you're doing SQL always-on availability groups or whether you're doing Exchange DAGs. Those are using local DAS hard drives and then doing replication across them. The key point here is there are many options, and don't always just assume that when you think cluster, think old school fiber channel.
SANs, right. We're no longer in the SAN world.
$1 million price tag. You can achieve low cost, high availability solutions. So let's talk about some of the requirements. So the disk needs to be a basic disk. You can create dynamic disks with clusters, but you need an add-on from Semantic Storage Foundation for Windows. Then you can actually create dynamic disks on a cluster, but natively in-box, you can only use basic disks. The disk can be either GPT or MBR. I would recommend GPT. GPT has a backup of the partition table at the end of the volume, so they have some better resiliency that they bring. So I would always be creating all of your disks using GPT these days.
That's just a general best practice.
General practice. Okay. Cluster, non-cluster, I would always use GPT. And then NTFS or REFS, for the most mainstream of your workload, you're going to stick with NTFS. You might use REFS for some archival scenarios with Windows Server 2012 R2, but you stick with NTFS. And then the storage needs to support persistent reservation commands. And the answer to that is just run validate. So we have our validate tool that we covered in the previous chapters, sections of this course. And just run validate. Validate will make sure the storage supports all the necessary SCSI commands needed to support clustering. But it needs to be a block-based storage, and it can't be SATA. That's one of the things. SATA doesn't support multi-initiator. Multipath is recommended, having multiple paths for resiliency between the two. And you can use storage spaces as a mechanism to get software resiliency out of a bunch of disks. So when we look at, there's kind of two different modes to run a cluster disk. One of which is kind of the traditional cluster disk, which is kind of a shared nothing. So imagine that you have some SanDisk, you got a iSCSI storage array, and you have a disk. And so that disk is only mounted, and NTFS is only mounted on one server at a time. And the application which accesses that volume runs on that server. So they reside in the same cluster group together, and they fail over together. So you'll have the app. So let's say you've got SQL. SQL is accessing a NTFS volume. You want the NTFS volume mounted on the same server which you're going to be accessing it from. So you fail those over as an incomplete entity together, and they move around together.
That's the cluster group, right?
That's
all
the cluster
units
group.
In that cluster
that's
group with the net name, the IP address, the disk, and the application.
Yes, and that's the smallest unit of failover. And that's ensuring the volume. It's a traditional disk, only mounted on one node at a time, and it fails over with the application and is mounted with the application as it moves. The other type of disk that we have is we actually have a clustered file system that we include in clustering. So it's called Cluster Shared Volumes is the name of our clustered file system. So that enables you to take, let's say you take that same iSCSI disk, and opposed to just having the volume mounted on one node at a time, you actually have it mounted on all the nodes at the time, and then they can all access it simultaneously. And then we have orchestration of access of the volume, which happens server-side between the nodes in the cluster. When you access a traditional disk, you're going to have a normal volume label assigned to it. Mount points also work, so if you want to create a mount point between the traditional disk and a root disk and a mount point disk. With cluster shared volumes, we're going to have a namespace. So one of the things that we ran into was running out of drive letters. So CSV helps solve that problem. So there's only so many letters in the alphabet, and you're going to have more than 24, let's say, volumes are going to run out of drive letters. So CSV enables you to solve that. We have C cluster storage, and then we have a volume and a volume number, and you can rename those whatever you want. But that enables you to kind of get past the volume letter drive letter limitations.
Now, besides the drive letter limitation, what would be another reason why people would use cluster shared volumes if they have a lot of virtual machines? Is there any impact with like failover, and what happens if you put multiple VMs on a single traditional disk? How does that get handled?
Sure. So CSV will actually get faster failover as well, because with a traditional disk, so if you think about it, you have a volume which is mounted on node 1, and you want to fail that over to node 2. You're going to fail over this virtual machine. You're going to have to dismount the NTFS file system. You're going to have to release those persistent reservations. We're going to have to renew those persistent reservations from this side, mount the file system, and then start the app. With CSV, it's just stop the app, start the app. Volume is always mounted, so you get the faster failover times.
So in the past, let's say I had two virtual machines on a traditional cluster disk. If one of those VMs had to move, what would happen to that other VM?
Yeah, you got to move them as a group. So if they're on the, remember that volume is only mounted on one node at a time. So if you had 50 VMs all running off the same volume, you would have to move all 50 VMs together.
Ooh, that's no good. That's why CSV is really going to come in handy then, right? Because you're not really moving that disk. It's always there, always attached to all of
them. So with CSV, you got 50 VMs on that same volume. That volume, when the VMs now become the smallest unit of failover. So those VMs will individually move without having to move the volume. So you got 50 VMs on a single volume with all those VMs owned by different nodes. So let's talk about the CSV file system. So the CSV file system enables a single namespace in the cluster. So there's no more drive letters, and we talked about that, and it leverages mount points. All the nodes have simultaneous access. It also gives increased resiliency. So CSV has resiliency so that if underlying connectivity to the storage fails, we will reroute I/O through another, like over the network between the nodes in the cluster.
And that's the redirected I/O access that we were talking about with the networking section, right?
Yep.
Okay.
And one of the really cool things about about CSV is there's the CSV block cache. So what the CSV block cache is all I/O, all Hyper-V I/O is unbuffered I/O. So there's no caching going on in the file system. So what CSV cache is a read-only write-through cache of reads. So when any read is done, we stick it in the CSV cache, and if there's a subsequent read of the block, then it will be serviced from cache without having to make a hit to disk. So that's significantly like VDI scenarios where you have multiple VMs which are accessing common blocks is going to significantly improve performance, and things like boot times will be significantly improved.
So is there any, there's definitely a lot of advantages to using cluster shared volumes for VMs. Is there any reason why you would want to still use a traditional cluster disk for a virtual machine?
No.
No, CSV is the way to go.
CSV is the way to go, and that's the way, that's the way to go.
And that's how we're architecting it, you know, internally on the engineering team. That's where all the focus is, right, for virtual machines, really trying to enhance that solution, make it more resilient and everything.
Absolutely, and that's actually where we're going long term. So we now, in 2012, added support for SQL as well. So now you can run SQL Server on cluster shared volumes. And so we're enhancing the workloads that you can support on cluster shared volumes. So let's kind of look at here at the architecture of CSVFS. So as you can look, we're using, so you have the SMB server, which is sitting on top of CSVFS. And it actually appears as that file system. It'll appear as CSVFS. If you open disk management, you will see it as CSVFS. And we do that for interoperability considerations so that ISVs know what they're running on top of. And then we use SMB as a protocol transport between the nodes in the cluster. And what it, the reality is that the NTFS file system is really only mounted on one node, and we're actually forwarding I/O metadata requests between the nodes in the cluster, and then reads and writes are going directly to the disk. And a metadata, so let's talk about what a metadata update. So a metadata update is anything like an open, a close. So you start a VM, you stop a VM. It's an extend. You have a dynamic VHD, and it's growing in 50 meg chunks, so it hits the size and it grows another 50 megs. You do a live migration. That's going to be a metadata update. So they're pretty infrequent, and they're small. So it's just these small I/O requests of orchestration of the metadata between nodes. But the actual data payload is going north-south down to the disk, and it's just this east-west orchestration, kind of our distributed lock manager of orchestration of metadata updates between the nodes in the cluster.
Now, one question is, we talk about sending the CSV traffic down to the file system from the host. Can we use any type of storage fabric? Can we use, you know, fiber channel? Can we use iSCSI, traditional or Ethernet based? So CSV is supported across all those different types of storage, right?
Yeah, any block storage. So you can use anything you saw in the diagram I had before. So whether it be fiber channel, iSCSI, FCOE, SAS, all works with CSV.
Now, generally, I think that we find, at least for virtualization, a lot of customers are still using traditional fiber channel, tends to be faster. But I also think, I mean, you're seeing more with the convergence and, you know, faster networking cards that we're seeing more and more people switch over to Ethernet-based storage now because the performance really is getting there. It's starting to get pretty comparable to fiber, and it's much cheaper. So feel free to use what makes sense for you there.
And then here in the bottom of this slide, you'll notice here's where it talks about we actually have some numbers around the differences between boot times. So you can see, you know, here we did some testing of boot times, and you can see CSV cache disabled versus enabled. You can see the numbers are radically different in the improvements you can get of CSV cache. So CSV cache is disabled by default. So that's one of those things that just, this is one of my tips. First thing you do when you do a Hyper-V deployment, you're going to use CSV as your storage, and you're going to want to go turn on CSV cache. I recommend starting out with like a gig, 2 gigs, but you have to allocate memory from physical RAM for the CSV cache.
So this means if I have a 64 gigabyte host and I'm allocating, let's say, 4 gigs to CSV cache, I then only have really 60 gigs of running memory.
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's correct. And the amount of memory you'll allocate will differ by the scenario. So on a Hyper-V host running local CSV, you may only allocate 2 or 4 gigs of RAM. But if you're running a scale-out file server, you actually may allocate a lot more. Maybe you'll allocate 10 gigs, 20 gigs, because you're going to have a lot of excess RAM not free to allocate to the cache. All right, and now let's talk about kind of the third way to configure Hyper-V storage, which is around using file-based storage. So the last two we were talking about were block-based storage, whether that be running local traditional disks or local CSV, local block storage. But you can also run Hyper-V over SMB, and that's file-based storage. So we kind of have block, we refer to that as block storage and file-based storage. And so you can have your VMs configured and they're accessed just by the SMB path. So WAC, share name, WAC, you know, my.vhd. And then you configure that against the scale file server. And we're going to talk about a scale file server in depth here pretty quick. And I'll show you how one works. We'll set one up. Another thing which we now include, we were talking about in our previous chapter, is that the way Simon and I have all of our demos set up is using the iSCSI software target. So that's actually included in Windows Server. It enables you to install this as a role feature. I think it's a feature. You can install the iSCSI target, and you can enable sharing up iSCSI LUNs to create simple test clusters very easy with any hardware you have laying around. Another thing which is new in Windows Server 2012 R2 is that we can now share a VHDX. So we have what's called shared VHDX, and enables a VHDX to be presented to multiple virtual machines at a time. So that enables creating guest clusters. So imagine I'm going to set up SQL cluster inside of two virtual machines. I need some sort of shared storage. Well, you can use a VHDX and actually present it up to multiple VMs at the same time, and then install SQL within those virtual machines to fail over SQL instances from one to the other. So that's extremely powerful. And that just appears as a SAS disk. All right, so let's go do a little demo and look at some cluster disks.
So while Alden switches over, we're going to be using his cluster one more time that he showed in the earlier demo. But what we're actually going to be doing over the rest of this course is Eldon's going to go create this concept of a scale-out file server on his cluster. I'm going to be creating Hyper-V virtual machines on my cluster, and then we're going to be pointing to each other to make our entire end-to-end solution highly available. But before we get to scale-out file server, traditional cluster disks.
All right, so let's go look at some cluster disks. So if I go here, I have Failover Cluster Manager open, and if I click on storage, and then under disks, I will see my individual disks which are clustered. You can see that I have a little 2 gig disk which has been allocated as my witness, as my disk witness. And then I have another disk which is added as a CSV. But let me show you how to add a disk. So let's take the scenario of what I did in the background was I created a LUN, I presented it to the two servers, and now once I've created the LUN, I can just go and click add disks. So clustering will go and detect that there's a new LUN presented to the servers.
And it has to be visible by all of the nodes, is that right?
It doesn't have to be visible by all of them. It could actually be visible by subset. We do support a scenario called asymmetric storage, where you only have a subset of nodes which have access to the drive. So we can support that as well.
Is it going to pick up local disks? If I just have a D drive and it's a single disk, will it show anything like that?
As long as it will not pick up the boot partition or the system, any disk which has the boot partition or the system partition on it.
Okay.
And it must be SAS, no SATA. All right, so if I click OK, then we'll go, and it will just automatically add my disk. So here you can see, here's my new disk that just got added, and it's in available storage. So you can see here.
What exactly is available storage? I keep seeing this pop up on the UI. Is that some management paradigm?
Yeah, it's just a way that we refer to the disks as meaning this is a free disk which is available to be, I'm using a verb to divide. Describe the word, but it's a free disk which is yet to be assigned to something. So
okay.
You've created it, you've clustered it, but you haven't put any app or you assigned it to a role yet, is what that really means. So at this point, either I could assign this to a role, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to add this to CSV. So let me show you something first. So one of the things about CSV, so if I click on my C drive, you see now I have a cluster storage directory. If I double click on cluster storage, you're going to see I have a volume one. And that volume one really maps to here. So if I look here, I can see here I've got a cluster shared volume. And you can see that it's got a C cluster storage volume one. It's got the free space. And it kind of gives you the same kind of experience.
Now, if I was logged onto the other node in the cluster, what would that access point look like?
It'd be exactly the same. So you'd open, you go to the other node, you'd open up C cluster storage. And you would see the same directory structure.
So the key thing here is all of the nodes, they have that same file path, right? So when they're writing, they're essentially going to write to C cluster storage volume name. And then that's going to be consistent across all of the nodes.
Yep.
Okay.
So if I go here and I look, so my disk is currently F. So this is a traditional disk. And if you look, it is owned by one node. So right now it's owned by node 2. I'm currently at node 1. So if I open up and I go look at my disks, I do not have a disk F, right? I do not have a disk F. Now, if I go and I am going to fail this disk over, actually, let's move available storage. So I'm going to do what's called a failover. So you see this volume is mounted on node 2. I've now dismounted the file system on node 2 and mounted on node 1. And now if I go in here, you will see now there is a disk F. And it kind of appears with a little double servers in the back to show you it's clustered. And then you go in here, and here's my new disk. So I can just create a new folder. And there's my new folder. I'm going to create something in my folder just to give us something for giggles here. All right, so there's my disk. It is clustered, and it is as F. As you can see, here's F. Traditional disk, only mounted one node at a time. I fail over back and forth. Now let's take this disk and let's add it to cluster shared volumes, because we said that's what you're going to do with virtual machines. There's like no reason not to be doing this. So you right-click on it, and you just go add to cluster shared volumes. That's really it. It's going to dismount the volume, remove it from being mounted as F, and remount it, and now it's as C cluster storage volume 2.
So I'm not going to see F anymore.
So okay. F is now vanished, and I can go into cluster storage, and here's my disk. And I'll double-click on that. Well, there's the folder we just created, and there's the file we just created. Now, you can also rename this if you want to. So if you don't like cluster volume 2, you can just like a directory, call it like, you know, marketing. This is going to be for marketing, saying, hey, if you rename this, there we go, you might break other people. So now it's marketing. So you can easily rename. So again, first you add it as a traditional disk, shows up in available storage, then you add it to cluster shared volumes. Here you can see it's updated, it shows up as marketing, and now I can go provision VMs on top of it.
Now, when I provision a VM and I go through that new virtual machine wizard, I want to make sure that I go and specify that C cluster storage and pick the volume, right? To make sure that I'm placing my VM configuration and virtual hard disk in that location.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And we'll actually be talking a little more about configuring the VMs in our next session on virtualization.
Okay. Let me go back.
Great. So I think the next topic we're going to be talking about is software-defined storage. This is definitely a term that we're hearing a lot about in the industry, but can you just kind of articulate what is it and why do we care about it as Microsoft?
Sure. So let me go into this. So we kind of had a big strategic shift when it came to Windows 2012. And it really two things that came in, two strategic shifts. The first part was around embracing file-based storage. So in the past, it was all about block-based storage. It was all about Fibre Channel, iSCSI, and SAS RBOTs. So it was all about block-based storage external. Now with 2012, we really embraced file-based storage in NAS. So running Hyper-V over Ethernet with a file-based protocol. In our case, we embrace SMB against a against the NAS. The other thing that we really has kind of changed the game is around storage spaces. So storage spaces enables really about taking a low-cost set of JBODs and combining them into a resilient storage. So I'm gonna we'll kind of talk about it about a second. So as we talk about our vision, so let's talk about kind of our storage vision and where are we going as Microsoft and where are we thinking about. So we really are about reducing storage costs. And that's kind of our main goal that we really kind of started this vision with Windows Server 2012 and around our infrastructure as a storage kind of vision. So the first thing is Hyper-V. So we believe in kind of at the Hyper-V, at the compute layer, low-cost commodity servers in a scale-out architecture. So when you go to a scale-out architecture, it's cost-inhibitive to go and stick expensive fiber channel HBAs in each and every one of the servers. So we really believe in Ethernet as the storage as the fabric topology that's going to win the compute layer. Now, the next point is about what is the protocol which runs on top of Ethernet. So we believe in Ethernet. The next thing is that we kind of believe in SMB as from Microsoft's strategy as the protocol to run over Ethernet, which is the file-based protocol for Hyper-V. So the next question is, what's the NAS backend? So you may have NAS devices today. Let's say you have a NetApp device, and it can talk SMB, and that can be your NAS device, and that's great. We also have a Microsoft story to enable NAS, and that's really about using a scale-out file server as the NAS head. On the back end, you can either leverage existing investments you have. So let's say you have Fibre Channel today, right? I mean, so we're about saving you costs, and we recognize that the cheapest storage is the storage you already paid for. Right? So you can take that existing Fibre Channel storage, iSCSI storage, plug it into a scale-out file server, reduce those costs of having that large, buying those additional Fibre Channel HBAs for each and every one of those compute servers, go to Ethernet, go to 10 gig Ethernet, go over SMB, go to against a scale-out file server, and then use spaces on the back end to achieve a low-cost storage solution. So that is our software-defined storage strategy right there. Kind of all up, that's it right there. And then System Center can manage this whole stack top to bottom. So we got System Center as a top to bottom management stack, disaggregated compute and storage running over SMB, scale file servers, and spaces on the back end. So let's talk about what a SAN is. So and we kind of just draw some analogies here. So if you look at a SAN, the first thing is It's just a bunch of, there's a bunch of disks inside of it, right? We got a bunch of disks, a bunch of spindles.
And you're talking about a SAN that you might buy from like a hardware vendor, right? A proper OEM. As we're really trying to say, you know, what's that $150,000 unit you're buying? This is what we're really trying to break down here.
Right, right. So you get your disks, and then there's some controllers. And those controllers are running, they're really just x86 PCs running software. And then usually there's some sort of a connectivity adapter to get into the controllers, whether that be fiber channel or Ethernet to get in via iSCSI or FCOE. So and then they shrink wrap in a single sheet of metal, and then they usually put a cool blue light too. You get the cool blue light for your money. So that's kind of what a SAN is when you think about it. So let's look at kind of the Microsoft management stack when we think about this. I went the wrong way. All right, so first off, you have your physical disks, just like you did before. You'll have, and those are just a JBOD, right? So those are some external JBODs, enclosures with storage inside of them, some SAS-based storage, and then connected in with some controllers, with some interface, some SAS HBAs. And then you're gonna have a controller. In this case, the controller is about moving that software up into Windows and having those scale-out file servers be the controllers. And then you have some sort of network connectivity. You have an Ethernet adapter to get into the controllers. So if you kind of look at what a traditional SAN has delivered versus the Microsoft software-defined storage strategy, they're very similar. It's just about moving that...
The brain of the operations, really, right?
Yeah, up into Windows.
Doing the tiering, the deduplication, that management. Instead of paying all that extra money to that third party, you now get that free with Windows Server.
Yep, so very powerful. So let's talk about the VMware management. So one of the things around VMware management was about that was really goal to achieve in Windows Server and System Center 2012 R2 was about really providing that end-to-end management. So being able to manage the entire solution end-to-end. So by that I mean, if you look at that entire stack, what VMware can now do is you can create your compute servers. Actually, let's start at the bottom. You can create spaces. You can have your disks, you can create spaces out of them. You can bare metal provision your scale-out file servers. You can create the scale-out file server head. You can create the shares. You can bare metal provision your compute Hyper-V servers. You can create VMs. You can send them, configure them across the shares. You can ACL the shares. You can do this whole thing end-to-end with VMM now. So it is now a single pane of glass to be able to manage your entire virtualization stack top to bottom. And that's very powerful. So when we think about storage, so one of the powerful things about VMM now is it can be a single pane of glass for storage. So how do we achieve this? So in the past, it used to be that if you had vendor X, you had to use their SAN management tools. You had vendor Y, you had to use their SAN management tools. And the inbox Windows tools didn't work with any of them. So now we've really worked to standardize that. So now we have what we call Storage Management API, or SMAPI. And it really provides this layer of abstraction between the management tools and the underlying storage arrays. So if you look at it, so vendors can go and write SMP-based providers, SMIS-compliant providers. I can have spaces. And they just map into SMAPI, that kind of blue box. And that is this layer of abstraction above whether it be inbox tools like Server Manager or System Center tools like VMM or even third-party tools. They all write the SMAPI, and they are abstracted from the uniqueness of the storage array, which enables them to have heterogeneous support across any different storage array. So that's something really powerful in a kind of a new strategy we have around storage management.
Yeah, as an example, and we'll talk a little more about this in our last section, you can have completely different underlying storage fabrics and manage it the exact same way. So essentially, you go add it to System Center Virtual Machine Manager, whether it's Fibre Channel, iSCSI, SAS. So long as we speak those APIs, you just go to the VMM interface, say, create a new LUN. We create it the exact same way. So this also reduces management and support costs. You no longer need to train your staff on how to manage those interfaces for those different arrays. So long as that storage is being used for virtualization, SCVMM could go centrally manage that with a consistent experience.
All right, so let's talk about some of the new features. So when we delivered spaces in Windows Server 2012, we really nailed the kind of the core resiliency features about creating, whether it be parity or mirrors, But one of the new features that we really kind of delivered in Windows Server 2012 R2 was about delivering a lot of the capabilities that you expect out of an enterprise-class storage array. So things like tiering, things like write-back caching, things like dedupe. So you'll now see these in the box. So with tiering, right, that you can have SSDs and HDDs reside in a storage pool. And when a virtual machine is going to do like a read, so hot blocks are actually mapped to the SSD tier, and cold data is then tiered back down to HDD tier. And it's the same with the write-back cache. So writing will go down to the SSD tier and then is later destaged off to the HDD tier. So this is just a lot of the powerful enterprise-class features that you expect out of a storage array are now on Windows Server 2012 R2. Okay, so let's talk about SMB storage. So we, like I said, our strategy is really about, when we think about a NAS, is about, and we believe in Ethernet and winning the fabric for the compute layer, and we're really betting our NAS strategy around SMB as a protocol transport. So you may know about SMB, kind of your mom and dad's SMB from two decades ago, was used traditionally for like, you know, file servers and Word documents and putting a, you know, copying little things up onto a file share. And so you may at first be like, you know, it may at first be, you know, conservative or concerned saying, hey, is that really something I want to run my storage over? Well, we've done radical performance improvements in SMB 3.0. So SMB 3, so if you look, compare like your mom's SMB 2 to SMB 3 today, so SMB 2 is roughly 40% of line speed, where SMB 3 is 98%. So it's radically faster than what you knew before. So if you haven't done SMB 3 between two SMB 3 clients, I recommend you go try that because it's something radically different. So here's, you kind of look at kind of the diagram. Here I have a scale-out file server, and you can have Hyper-V virtual machines running over against an SMB share to run that virtual machine and host the VMs. So here's one of the really cool things about the scale-out file servers, was we started to think about it. So when we first started running Hyper-V over SMB early in the Windows 2012 days, we configured a VM, we set it up against a traditional file server, and then we walked up and yanked the power cord to the back of the file server. And every VM that was running against that share crashed. So we had like, we thought it'd be really bad. You got 1,000 VMs up and running against the share, and the share goes down, and all those VMs crash. We thought that was completely unacceptable, and we needed to build a resilient story for file-based storage. So we've actually done that. So what a scale-out file server actually does is that you will actually have completely transparent failover in the event of an unplanned outage. So both planned and unplanned are completely transparent. So let's say you have a two-node scale-out file server, and you will actually have a share. So let's talk a little bit about a scale-out file server. So basically, you'll have a share, you'll have a name, and the name will be bound on both machines. And then DNS, we actually register the IPs of both of the nodes. So what happens is that when a Hyper-V client wants to connect to the share, he will go talk to the DNS server. The DNS server will use DNS round robin and will randomly distribute the client request across the different nodes. So the client request comes into a particular node and then is accessing the storage and gets to the VHD. If you walk up and yank the power cord to the back of that server, all of those SMB sessions will seamlessly transition over to another server, and that Hyper-V VM will stay running. So that's the real power of the scale-out file server. Another thing that we introduced was SMB multi-channel. So what SMB multi-channel does is it enables you to stream across multiple SMB, across multiple network interfaces at the same time to really get that bandwidth aggregation across multiple physical servers. We also wanted to do hardware offloading. So offloading and taking advantage of the capabilities in the NICs, such as RDMA. So with what we call SMB Direct, what SMB Direct does is it does offloading to minimize the CPU impact of storage of SMB communication between the host and between the compute and the storage layer. So this can significantly, at a compute layer, right, you obviously want to use all of your CPU cycles and memory for VMs, running VMs, and you don't want to consume that with just the network. You want to offload that to the hardware if at all possible. So let's talk about Hyper-V and protocols it can run over. So I have kind of three kind of, there's a graph here if you look at the live migration times. So in Windows Server 2012, we introduced live migration and there was no compression. Then in Windows Server 2012, we wanted to enhance the story. So we actually introduced compression for live migration traffic. So if you look at kind of on the right, so you'll see what is TCP/IP, which is what it was in Windows Server 2012.
About then, 65 seconds there?
Yeah, about 65. And then you'll see when you turn on compression in Windows Server 2012, live migration times are significantly faster. That's just the default in what you run.
Looks like about five times faster there in that example.
Yep. And now with another thing you can do is you can set live migration to actually run over SMB. Now, you'll notice the times between compression and SMB is a little bit better. It is a little better. But the real value is that when you're doing compression, it takes a lot of CPU effort to do the compression on the compute side, push over side, and decompress it. If you're using SMB with, if you have RDMA-enabled NICs, then you could offload that all to hardware. So you can get not only faster live migration times, but you can significantly reduce the CPU impact of doing a live migration. So golden rule is if you're using RDMA-enabled NICs, so A, get RDMA-enabled NICs, and if you have them, use SMB as your protocol transport for live migration. You're going to get better performance and significantly less impact on CPU on the Hyper-V host. Now, SMB is starting to be used by many different things, and not all things are equal. So you can have SMB traffic for doing file copies. You have a VM library, and you're provisioning a VM, and you're going to copy it to the compute layer. You can be doing SMB, we just talked about, between the hosts before live migration. You're going to be doing SMB for CSV traffic between the nodes. And you can have SMB as a backend to your NAS scale-out file server for Hyper-V. So we now introduce some bandwidth management, which will allow you to control to say, hey, I don't want a file copy to go and choke all of my SMB traffic. So you can have one, you can set this bandwidth management so that I will restrict a file copy, yet I want to have unrestricted storage layer. One of the other things that's new in Windows Server 2012 R2 is that we now support online resizing of shared VHDX. We also introduced some quasi policies for shared VHDX, and then some VM metrics that you can go and monitor the normalized IOPS and latency for those virtual machines.
And I just want to add one note with the VHD resize. We're not just talking about growing, but we can actually shrink that virtual hard disk as well with no downtime for the virtual machines in case you need to reallocate storage or adjust things around in your file system. So it does go both ways.
Data duplicate, so I talked about we needed to include the enterprise class features of a storage array in software. And another part of that is around deduplication. So we have deduplication, which is included in Windows Server, which you can use to dedupe VHDs. So that could be either offline VHDs, and in 2012 R2, we can actually dedupe online VHDs. Really kind of focused around VDI scenarios is the kind of the sweet spot, because it's about taking common chunks across multiple VHDs and then reducing them. So in a VDI scenario, you may, in a personal VM with VDI, personal VMs with VDI, you may have, you know, those same chunks across multiple VMs, and it can dedupe those and get like 90% space savings. So some important things about running Hyper-V over SMB. So when running Hyper-V over SMB, you need to be running SMB 3.0. We don't support the legacy versions. That means both that the Hyper-V client, so that means what you're running on your Hyper-V compute servers, needs to be running Windows Server 2012 or later. And on your backend storage array, you're going to be wanting running Windows Server 2012 or later as well. There are third parties which have implemented SMB 3.0, NetApp, EMC have, and others have implemented it. So if you're going to be using a third-party NAS, be sure they support SMB 3.0 and make sure that's what you're running. And again, from a management perspective, fully manageable from VMM. Active Directory is required. Because it is a share, we need to do ACLing and authentication against that. Okay, and with that, let's talk about a scale-out file server. So we talked a little bit about a scale-out file server. So here's kind of the depiction of what we have in our disaggregated story for a private cloud. So at the top, we have some compute. We have Hyper-V servers, could be up to 64 in a cluster. We have multiple clusters running over Ethernet. It could be Ethernet or InfiniBand, actually. Let me correct. So it could be Ethernet or InfiniBand running over SMB. And then here I have my scale-out file server. So I have my single logical file server name. So I have a single name, which is bound to all nodes in the cluster. Again, we go register them, that name and IPs, the IP of each node in DNS. Then DNS round robin handles distributing those incoming client connections across the nodes. Then we have a single file system namespace. That's cluster shared volumes. So cluster shared volumes, on any node you go to, you're gonna see those shares. And we keep the shares that you create replicated across all the nodes. So whatever node you go to, you're gonna get to that share. So it's a true active-active system that you can come into any node and get access to the files. What else is interesting here?
Well, I also want to kind of really emphasize one point here as well. Based on this topology, we are looking at two separate clusters. We have our Hyper-V cluster that just runs the virtual machine. Then we have our scale-out file server cluster, which runs this active namespace. Now, could you put both the the scale-out file server and Hyper-V virtual machines on the same physical servers on the same cluster?
Yeah, I mean, you traditionally want to keep those roles separate. So you want to keep your compute at one layer and your storage at another one. Now you could run, if you want to run local block storage, having like Fibre Channel connect directly, and then you have CSV local opposed to doing remote over SMB. But when doing file-based storage strategy, you want to keep them separated. Let's also talk about scale. So with your compute, you're going to have low-cost commodity scale out. On your scale-out file server, usually the normal scale is going to be 2 nodes, 3, maybe 4. More than 4, we don't see customers doing a whole lot more than 4. So when you think about your scale-out file server, just 2, 3, 4 servers is all you really want. So here, as we kind of look at the architecture for a scale-out file server and its capabilities. So again, you have those shares which are created and they are managed across all the nodes in the cluster. There is a witness service. And so what the witness service is doing is it is monitoring the SMB clients and it is detecting when those SMB sessions are broken and then telling other nodes when they should redistribute them and where they should reconnect to. So it is kind of the brains behind the engine, which is then redirecting the SMB sessions when nodes die, and it detects that nodes are lost. So let's talk a little bit about interop. So a scale-out file server. So there's kind of this, when do I use, one of the big questions we got to customers is, when do I use a traditional general purpose file server you've known for the last decade, and when do I use a scale-out file server? A scale-out file server is designed to be storage for applications. That's the key point. So if you remember anything, remember that. Hyper-V, SQL, great things to run over SMB on the back end. If you want it now, if you want to deploy a traditional file server for Word, Office, PowerPoint, Excel, home directories, you want to deploy a traditional file server. And the reason for that is a couple different things. And if you look at this chart here, it kind of breaks down the features which are supported. And the answer is that there a lot of the what we call IW file server, information worker file server features are not supported on a scale-out file server. Such as file classification is a big one. So you're probably going to want file classification on a traditional file server for Word docs and PowerPoints and bitmaps and MP3s and things like that. But you're not going to want that. That is not really relevant in a scale-out file server when you're doing a back-end NAS storage array over SMB for Hyper-V and SQL. So again, there are different scenarios that you want these two features.
Now there is an acronym on the screen I just kind of want to clarify here, CA. So things only work if CA is enabled on the share. What exactly is that acronym?
So CA responds to, so there's two different forms of an SMB share now. So you have your traditional SMB share and you have what's called a CA share, which is a continuous availability share. And a CA share is what enables that, when I talked about you could yank the power cord on the back of a server, and those SMB sessions would seamlessly transition to another server. It's a CA share which enables that seamless functionality. Now, a CA share, does not have any caching involved with it. That's how we get some of that seamless connectivity. That doesn't matter for an app workload like Hyper-V because Hyper-V does all unbuffered I/O. So it's all unbuffered I/O, no caching, straight down to the disk. The fact that SMB is not caching it, and then it doesn't matter, and then you can get the seamless failover. Now that has some impact, a CA share for a traditional file server. So I've seen people try to go do like file copies against the CA share and go, well, it's slower. And the answer is, well, they'll compare a normal share to a CA share. And the answer is absolutely yes, it's slower because you're doing an extending write, a buffered file copy, which will then be cached by the SMB share, non-CA share, and then is not cached by the CA. So you're talking about a cache versus uncached solution scenario, and the performance is worse. But it's important to remember that that's not relevant to Hyper-V scenario because that's all unbuffered I.O. So a lot of times people do a file copy and be like, oh, my Hyper-V I.O. performance is going to be affected. And it's a completely false kind of assumption because you're doing a buffered
It's a different traffic pattern, essentially.
Yeah, buffered I.O. against a cached share versus what you're really doing is unbuffered I.O. against an uncached share.
Not a fair comparison.
Yeah.
So I think kind of the key point here is, you know, make sure that as you're going and deploying these, you step through the wizards. It will actually say, is this going to be continually available? Is this a scale-out file server? Is it used for applications? So as you're going and picking those, just make sure that you're aware of what type of deployment, what type of network traffic you're going to be using that for. So are you ready to take a look at the demo here?
All right, let's go take a look at the demo here. All right, so I'm just gonna create a scale file server. So first thing we did, remember, we created our disks. So we added a disk, we added it to CSV. So the first thing to remember is that a scale-out file server requires a CSV disk. You cannot use a traditional legacy disk with a scale-out file server. So you create a CSV disk, and then you click here on roles, and you can just go configure role. So if you go configure role.
Now what is this wizard? This is the first time we've actually introduced this wizard. Could you just kind of speak about that generally too?
Sure. So this is a wizard which enables you to create highly available applications on a cluster. So if you want to create a highly available Wind server, or you want to create a highly available file server or DHCP, it's just a wizard to help you set it up.
Now, in this case, we are going to be selecting the file server, but we do get the option. Here we go. This is what I'm looking for.
Yep. So you're going to select file server. And when you get to this, remember I talked about there a minute ago that there's two modes of a file server. There's the file server for general use, which is what you're going to use for, we talked about IW file server for
Office docs,
Office,
that type of stuff, right?
MP3s, JPEGs. And then here is a scale-up file server for application data. So this is the scale-up file server for our Hyper-V. So we're going to select this one. And then we're just going to give it a name. We'll hope that works. There we go. And then just want to make sure I didn't have a duplicate computer object of that name. And then so it goes ahead and creates the computer object. Tells me where it stuck it. Here's it's in the OU workstation, blah, blah. And here is my new scale-up file server that I just created. So if I go here, you will see that it says, hey, this storage is accessible through C cluster storage. And then if I look at my resources, you will see that I have a network name resource. Now for the cluster people, you will see what's different between the traditional and the scale-up file server is there's no IP address resource. And that's because we're using the IP addresses of each individual local server. And then you'll see the scale-out file server. And the scale-out file server actually creates the shares on each individual node. So you'll see if I go to summary, here's my node, here's the resources, and then I can go and add shares to this. So I can actually just go, and then if I go, let's see, to any of my CSV volumes, I can go and just create shares, and then my shares will be provisioned through the scale-out file server and visible to all the nodes in the cluster.
Now, I see this option on the right, add file share. Do we have like some type of integration here with Windows Server File Services that allows us to do it straight through Failover Cluster Manager?
Yep, so you can just create this. I just created it, so the name is actually here. I actually have another one. Let me go to my other one. And
now, that error was expected. Basically, what you saw there was the client name propagation, a delay. So we just waited for some DNS replication to happen. And then, you know, in 30 seconds, 2 minutes, that would be available. But we went cooking show style. We created one earlier. So let's go take a look at that one.
So here you can see, if I look at my directory structure, so if I go to C, cluster storage, volume 1, and here's the My VMs directory. So then if I go look at this, you will see here is my actual share associated with that. So here's the C cluster storage, My VMs share. So I can actually go, let's see if I can go and browse this. What was my name? Alden C. So I can browse my scale-out file server, and then here's my share, and this is actually going to dynamically route me to one of my two nodes in the cluster, and then here I am at my share, and then you would create your VHDs and access them. So this would be the actual path, so when you go to create your VMs, this is the actual path you would use to place your virtual machines. Okay, and with that, let's flip back.
So give us the summary.
Okay, so just kind of recapping everything, let's just talk about our software-defined storage stack. And so again, looking at the overall stack, top to bottom, you've got compute. We believe in Ethernet winning as the low-cost storage topology. We believe in Ethernet as the protocol for our NAS-based solution. You can use existing NASs like, third-party NAS like NetApp, EMC. We have a solution with scale-up file servers that you can create with CSV. Now, you can leverage existing storage you have today. You got fiber channel-based storage. You want to embrace scale-up file servers, go for it. But if you want a low-cost alternative for the next time you go to do a hardware refresh, you should look at Spaces. And we have Spaces which can deliver low-cost storage alternatives with JBODs on the back end.
Great. Well, that wraps up our module about cluster storage and the scale-out file server. Come back shortly, and we will be taking a look at virtualization with Hyper-V on a failover cluster.